Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet Philip Mann, the guest conductor for the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra concert this weekend as he leads the TSO in Rachmaninoff Symphony No. 2, Samuel Barber's Essay No. 1 for orchestra, and the Mozart Horn Concerto No. 2 with orchestra principal Bruce Schultz as soloist. Mann is the music director of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra in Little Rock, where he's in his fifth season. And during his tenure there, the interest in the orchestra has grown greatly with sold-out performances, a balanced budget, and a growing orchestra. In fact, this fall they'll be moved back into a newly renovated Robinson Concert Hall. Mann was formerly the associate conductor of the San Diego Symphony and maintains an active guest conducting schedule with orchestras both across the United States and in Europe. He'll be leading the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Chapman Music Hall. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Philip Mann, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, it's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
And what is it like coming back to the orchestra this time around? It's been a couple seasons, hasn't it?
It has. I think it's been at least two, if not three. Yeah. It's a real pleasure. We had such a great experience last time. For your listeners, for any of them that came to that performance, we did Beethoven 5 and two premieres of Sam Adler, and challenging program, but came off so well. And the orchestra and I had a great chemistry, and we all look back on it as this really kind of fun and triumphant week. So walking into the rehearsal last night, a lot of smiling faces and the feeling of friends getting back together.
What do you like about this particular program?
I mean, all three pieces on this program are so special. I think if I had to say one thing on the program, it's that these pieces go really well together from a sonic acoustic perspective. There's a sumptuous, wonderful kind of richness that you hear in the Rachmaninoff that is also reflected in the string writing of the Barber. But then one similarity between the Mozart and then both Rachmaninoff and Barber is that there's a transparency and a clarity that really lends something to all three works. So while we may be in some ways kind of indulging ourselves in that wonderful buttery, cream cheese richness of Rachmaninoff and that string playing and the Barber, it's the transparency of a classical ideal that really lets us see through all three of these works and appreciate all the interesting things on the inside of the music.
Let's talk about the Barber, Samuel Barber. You called it an essay. It was originally the essay for orchestra, and then he decided to write another one and another one. So it became Essay No. 1. Mm-hmm. Why do you think he chose the name essay? Because that had never been used in music before.
I've never heard a really convincing or evocative description of why he chose that title. I think it doesn't do the piece a great deal of service in terms of programmers. I think, and what I mean by that is especially if you look at the programming history of the work outside the borders of the United States. It's not played nearly as much as it should be because it's a fantastic piece. The second essay, as you know, is a masterpiece on the highest order, and it's also not played outside the United States very often. And I think the title is part of that. Also, part of it's just the lack of ubiquity of Barber outside the States, but he's still growing in popularity, particularly if you look at Scandinavian orchestras and orchestras in the UK. This work, for me, I think, it has some of those trademark qualities of Barber that endeared him to U.S. audiences from the beginning. I mean, certainly Toscanini's approach to premiering these works had a huge influence on its immediate success. But the very first moments where you hear this melancholy, dark, kind of almost not brooding sound in the strings, because there's almost like this sense of hope that's built into this sinewy harmonic connection between the different small phrases.
Little sustained notes that resolve. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. It's immediately reminiscent of the Adagio for Strings, which when you look at the history of it, he was actually orchestrating the Adagio for Strings for a string orchestra at the same time as writing this, so because it was originally from a string quartet, of course. And he sent both of those pieces together to Toscanini as an example of his work.
Yeah, you mentioned Toscanini premiering these pieces. That was pretty rare for Toscanini. I mean, Toscanini did not take all that kindly to contemporary American works when he was here in the United States.
That's right. And I don't think it's necessarily a mark on Toscanini. It's just that, he was known for his repertoire. And certainly young American composers weren't necessarily Toscanini's repertoire. But Menotti had a big part in this, Rudinsky. And in fact, Barber was invited to come to New York and to meet Toscanini, and he refused to go because he thought that because Toscanini did not respond to him when he sent those pieces, that he wasn't interested. And Toscanini responded to say, "Oh, don't worry about Samuel. He's just angry with me. I didn't respond. I'll do both of his pieces anyway."
Interesting. Well, that opens the concert. Let's hear a little bit of Samuel Barber's music here. Let's hear a recording. My guest today is Philip Mann, Artistic Director of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra, who will be leading the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra in the music of Barber, along with Mozart and Rachmaninoff, this Saturday evening. Here's music from Samuel Barber's Essay Number 1. Music by Samuel Barber of the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra will play that piece along with a Mozart Horn Concerto and the Rachmaninoff Symphony No. 2 this Saturday evening at the Chapman Music Hall. Now, the second work, and I don't know if you do this at Arkansas, do you feature members of your orchestra as soloists from time to time?
Absolutely. I found that's probably the best way to develop that relationship between an audience and the orchestra itself. It humanizes the musicians. It gets people rooting for the musicians as if they're their favorite players on their favorite sports team. And for me, there's nothing really more enjoyable than sharing the stage with a colleague that way. And you look out into the orchestra and you see them all rooting for their colleague out in the spotlight. And the Mozart, of course, another thing that really connects this whole program together is the use of the horn as a solo voice. In all three works, the horn is very prominently featured. I think it's why you'll see our great principal playing all three when he might be forgiven to just play the concerto this concert.
Right, and that's sort of rare in and of itself. When you have a big horn concert, you know, to play all three, but a concerto is a part of it as well. Now, Bruce Schultz is playing the solo. Mm-hmm. Bruce has been a fixture in our music scene for, I would say, almost 40, 50 years at this particular point. I mean, he started in this old Philharmonic when he was in college.
Well, Bruce and I really hit it off in rehearsal. I love his playing. He's got such a wonderful sensibility and range of color and texture for a principal. And he told me last night that this is the first time he's played this concerto. He's done all of the others numerous times. He's saved the opportunity to do this one. And I think one reason for that maybe is that it also doesn't have a cadenza. There's a little bit less playing, and he can save a little bit of those chops for the Rachmaninoff too.
Now, the horn concertos are famous, at least some of them, for the comments Mozart put in the score to Leutgeb, who was the guy who premiered it for him, and it was basically was badgering the soloist all in the notes. Is this one of those concertos, or is this before that?
No, it absolutely is. I'll tell you the manuscript inscription. I don't know if on public radio you may need to bleep it. He says to my good friend, Leutgeb, he says, "Ass, ox, and fool, Vienna, 17... the date." and they ribbed each other, and they were great friends. In fact, when he eventually left music, and well, he didn't totally leave music, but he wanted to just focus on his solo activities, he moved to Vienna and opened a cheese shop. So then they maintained their friendship, they maintained their correspondence. I just love that inscription because it's a reminder of what a character Mozart was and what a human and fun character he was. And that, there's no better place to find that than in the concerti. I mean, especially the late piano concerti as well. But you get that sense of just puckish, mischievous humor mixed with the triumphant sounds of the horn in this case. And for all musicians, Mozart is almost like a dear friend. I mean, you get to know him from so many sides, but this is the side that makes you smile.
And of course, along with that, those late concertos, when he's writing the outer movements, again, they have all this bravura, they have that puckish humor, but then he'll write the middle movement where the adagio is just heart-rending.
Boy, there's nothing like, you know, Andante or an adagio second movement of Mozart, is there? I mean, in the last 3 weeks, I've done the clarinet concerto, C major No. 21 piano concerto, and now this. And It reminds you of why you want to be a musician when you have these moments. You know, we often use the word sublime maybe too cavalierly, but if you want to find yourself in a sublime place, start with a second movement of Mozart.
Well, you mentioned two that are just absolutely classics. The Adagio from the Clarinet Concerto has been used in film numerous times. The middle movement of the 21 Concerto, El Verum Madigan. That's another sort of classic that people, even if you don't know Mozart, you go, oh, I know that song. What about the Adagio in this particular one?
Well, I mean, it has those wonderful characters of pathos and beauty and a sense of almost painful yearning in some of the phrases, but it sets you up for a great finale too.
What about the juxtaposition of doing, you know, Mozart, which we think of having this sort of transparency to it, versus Rachmaninoff and Barber? Do you think it makes a nice counterpoint, or are there more corollaries than we might think?
I think it's the best thing to do when you have a work like Rachmaninoff. Let me give you an example. Let's say you're doing a big Shostakovich symphony. I often like to pair it with Haydn. Mahler goes great with Mozart. Anytime you have something that has a very complicated and dense texture, it's good for not just the musicians to get into their DNA and kind of take these vitamins with a classical work with greater transparency, greater connection, indeed more of a chamber music aesthetic, let's say, or approach. It helps the audience too, because it gets your ears so finely tuned to hold on to small little things that you may love. And that's my role in some of these programs, is kind of to direct your attention to it. And it prepares us all to get into these more complicated and more dense textures that we'll find in the Rachmaninoff. The secret for a great performance of the Rachmaninoff Second Symphony, I think, is finding a way for all of this to feel like you're doing it in your living room as chamber music, to connect, to foster all of these connections between the violas and the clarinets, the trombones and the first violins. These unfamiliar connections in some cases, where musical groups that aren't used to listening on that level to each other, that's when you have really special things happen.
And do you have moments like that in the Rachmaninoff?
All over the place. And I mean, pretty much the score is replete with moments of, oh, I just noticed that the tuba is playing with the inside of the string section, and they have a different articulation, and they have a different dynamic marking, but the tuba is actually where the strings need to be listening. And often it's that, you know, the tuba will listen to the basses. But in fact, in this case, we're asking people to listen maybe even in a direction on stage physically that they're not used to as much. Again, it comes back to this essence of chamber music amongst friends. Rehearsing this symphony almost feels like rehearsing a grand string quartet.
Really? Even though it's this large orchestra?
Well, you know, I've often found that the more people you have on stage, the more it can feel, when it's great, like you have a small group. I can think of performances of, let's say, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony with 400-person chorus, and you've got 500 people on stage. It's the smallest movements of a conductor that can make 500 people do something. You can get easily worked up into this notion of, look at all these moving pieces on stage. And musicians, we think, oh, gosh, we've got all, you know, a first violin section of 16 people. But when you really approach it like chamber music, you forget about the number of people, and it's just then the number of voices and whose voice is more important when, and who has that really interesting bit on the inside that we want to elucidate from the texture.
You mentioned earlier your job, you feel, is directing the audience's attention to these moments that you're talking about. How do you go about doing that? I mean, is it in your preparation? Is it in sort of focusing the player's attention that this is really important, even though it may not seem important in the overall scheme of the thing?
Well, it's definitely not something I think about from a conducting standpoint. It's purely a rehearsal process and my score study. So all of those wonderful, lovely bits that I want to bring out, my favorite things here, or that great idea that the principal clarinet had in rehearsal, you know, all those little things that we want to bring to people's attention, I simply am making it clear to all of the musicians that that is a focus of our listening and sound. And if people are paying attention to what I'm doing in the audience, it will probably direct their ears as well. I think more and more so, we're a visual society. And that's one reason why concerts are that much more special and rare, these types of experiences. That being said, we do somehow a little bit listen with our eyes. If you think about it, you know, when you want to really hear something on stage, like, oh, you heard an oboe line, you're going to look at the oboe, and it helps you to hear it. So it's mainly just using that as an additional tool to help us direct our listening to what we think is so special at any moment.
Yeah. Well, when we talk about this Rachmaninoff Symphony No. 2, it's a large piece. Mm-hmm. I think it can be as long as an hour. I don't know if you're going to do the whole thing or a lot of times there are popular cuts you take, but keeping that focus is a big issue. And as you approach this work, is there a particular part that you really love to help connect an audience with?
I think Rachmaninoff, especially since the late 50s, but especially in the early 70s, has really started to garner the respect and reputation of the great composer that he was. And what I mean by that is truly a symphonist and a composer that wrote with phenomenal architecture and form. And you can see his growing reputation as a composer as directly correlated to the change in the traditions of making cuts to his works. So prior to about 1955, it was not just fashionable but standard that everyone took large cuts. So the 66-minute work really was played in about 34 minutes. That being said, if you look at the top orchestras in the United States and abroad, starting about the middle 70s, you won't really find anybody who takes any cuts at all, other than maybe little snippets here and there that are almost easily to be missed, perhaps. So we're doing the whole thing. The only difference that this is what I think audiences expect now. It's what musicologists would make the case for. It's what I think is important for me in terms of maintaining the extraordinary cathedral-like architecture of this big form, this big work. We do not take the first movement repeat, however. And that's purely because I think for me, my allegiance is not just to the composer's writing, but to his intentions and indeed to the success of the work. And I think the form holds together better as work if we don't take the first movement repeat. All that put together is to say that the work is about 60 minutes long, and that's a tall drink of water,
yes, it is.
As you might say here. And the challenge then, to answer your question in a long way here, is how do you maintain that form? How do you maintain the pace so that you can constantly be moving through this without losing energy, without losing attention? And you can easily be seduced by these extraordinary melodies and extraordinary harmonic moments.
And an extraordinary power that happens throughout in many moments in the symphony.
Oh, I mean, spoken like a great trombone player there. Because, boy, the brass can just take you to incredible heights in moments in this piece. And that's the real challenge. And I think the thing that I'm focusing on is how do we show all of these special moments? How do we feel the emotion, the pathos, the beauty? I mean, just astonishing beauty in moments of this piece, but not so much change the pace that we lose the overall form.
Yeah, and that's, you know, we were talking about how Rachmaninoff's had a reassessment in recent years. And I think audiences have always loved Rachmaninoff because it was relatable. It was lush. It was romantic. But I think perhaps Rachmaninoff wrote them too late. You know, as far as, you know, the taste in music was changing, and all of a sudden this lush is no longer in favor. Do you think that had something to do with it?
I think his harmonic language wasn't in fashion, you know, because that was the height of modernity then, when things were really moving so fast in so many different directions that it became not just fashionable, but I think a lot of people might have even used the word honorable to disparage his compositional language and facility. I mean, it was the thing in the 40s and 50s was essentially to say, well, he should have just focused on one or the other, performing as a pianist or as a composer. But you can tell in his works that he was spending too much of his energy at the piano. And this just seems absurd to our, you know, modern ears now, because you think of all of the great composer / performers throughout history. It was just a fashionable thing to say at the time. And lucky for us, academia has really put a change to that conversation now over the last 40 years. And he's really inherited that mantle of a great 20th century composer now. Another thing is that his language also corresponded to some of the heyday of the great cinematic Hollywood style of writing. And it's hard not to make the connection of that almost kind of broad scope of like a Lawrence of Arabia type score with the exoticism, the sheen, the flair, the technicolor orchestration of this work. Into ears of people in the 40s and 50s, yeah. That's evocative of Hollywood.
Yeah, or Newman or Korngold or any of those classics.
Oh, you know, right. Roja.
Yeah, right.
Prokofiev, mm-hmm. You know, the great film score writers, you know. I think that connection didn't necessarily do him service either. I think one of the great things about modern audiences, especially when you look at younger modern audiences, they're not quick to make distinctions or judgments based on where someone is drawing their material from. I've done several commissions and world premieres this year that were well received by high school kids. And they had elements of everything from music from the Middle East to, you know, 17th century Western classicism to jazz. And I think you go on someone's iPod now and they have music from all over the place. And this is why the future of art form is very bright indeed.
Well, let's hear a little music by Rachmaninoff here. This is from the Symphony No. 2, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra by my guest today, conductor Philip Mann, the artistic director of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra. Let's hear music from Rachmaninoff. That's music from the Symphony No. 2 by Rachmaninoff, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Saturday evening, a program consisting of Barber, Mozart, and the Rachmaninoff Symphony No. 2. My guest is Philip Mann, the artistic director of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra, who will be guest conducting the Tulsa Symphony. Well, this is a very busy time for you. You have several new recordings coming out, one with the London Symphony Orchestra doing a Brahms Concerto No. 2, Piano mm-hmm. Concerto No. 2. Tell us about that. And it's a big label, Deutsche Grammophon.
Oh, it was one of the great experiences of my music life so far, which started off as I was a little bit apprehensive because I'd never worked in Abbey Road before, you know, and everyone wants to be in Abbey Road. You cross the street in front, and you imagine you're a Beatle.
Yeah, right.
You know, and you think you walk in, you've got a picture of Elvis and Michael Jackson and everybody else that's worked in there. But for me, it was, you know, it was going in an unfamiliar surrounding. Now, of course, the London Symphony, we all have their sound and in our ears and the great personalities in that group. But Abbey Road is a little bit infamous as a place to record because it's tough to hear on the podium.
Oh, really?
So you have to trust your musicians. You have to trust your producer. And it was an extraordinary thing because it took about 15 seconds and I realized we're not going to be just okay, but this is really something special. And there was just something in the air that week and the Brahms just came off brilliantly. Norman Krieger, who's the pianist on that recording, who's a phenomenal Brahms player. We'd had a few experiences sharing the stage before in Brahms. So it was a reconnection of kind of two kindred spirits approaching a work of symphonic proportions. It's basically a symphony, but then it has some of those gorgeous, endearing, small little moments. I mean, the end is like having Viennese coffee in a cafe in heaven or something. It's a joy for me, the great joy was the collaboration and knowing that we had that kind of chemistry with the London Symphony. I can't wait to work with them again. It was just a great time.
Now, you have another recording out coming up with the Scottish National Orchestra as well.
Yeah, we're working on one right now at Royal Scottish National. And that's a work, an orchestra that American audiences may not be as familiar with, but they're phenomenal, especially their brass section. And actually, their principal winds are just rock stars in Europe. So this is a project that I'm excited about. It's actually a new works. Mm-hmm. Several of them will be world premiere recordings. Anytime you do a world premiere recording, It's a double-edged sword because on one side, you've got the extra excitement of a world premiere. I mean, this is, but then you also have kind of the responsibility to send this work out. I mean, these works will have been premiered, of course, on stage, But the world premiere.
But you'll be the reference.
You have to send it out in a way that other people will have legs, as we say. Mm-hmm. So in other, you're kind of taking care of someone's child almost and sending them out into the world, this electronic ether, and you want to do it in the best way, and that's a great responsibility. Of course, that's not what we think about when we're recording. We're thinking about the music and pulling off a great performance.
Now, how much of your time is spent in Europe versus the United States? Are you going back and forth pretty regularly?
This season, when I'm not in Arkansas or actually here in Tulsa this week, I've mostly been in Europe and a little bit in Asia. I work in Korea a little bit right now, particularly in Eastern Europe, and then a little bit in Georgia. I'm working at a festival, the Batumi Music Fest, on the Black Sea and with the National Opera Orchestra in Tbilisi, and then some orchestras in the UK too. So for me, this variety is something that I really treasure as a conductor, because there's a very different approach and sensibility I find in rehearsals in Europe, and there's perhaps an extra interest in kind of creativity and metaphor and evocative imagery and things like this. And for me, it's always just a rejuvenating experience to work over there. Yeah. That being said, you can't say anything bad about the American orchestra tradition, because people come with amazing expertise and skills and talent, and they show up to the first rehearsal ready to go. And you know, working in Tulsa this week, you know, this is on display all of the time. People come in ready to make music in the first rehearsal, and this is a special thing.
Of course, in about a month, you're going to open a new concert hall at your home in Arkansas.
Yeah, you know, Arkansas, I've been a part of a team there and an incredible story. And we're thrilled that this is becoming an international story. Other orchestras are using us as models. And I was even told recently that the Cleveland Orchestra is referencing our business model right now as a vibrant, thriving artistic orchestra that's doing it sustainably. And we're opening a new concert hall in November, and that'll be our new home. We've recently opened several other smaller halls, I think actually 7 in total around our state that we have a presence at, but also in a smaller hall in Little Rock, and a new office headquarters with our own chamber hall. And we're doing this at the same time as having just sold out every concert since last December and doing it 7 years in the black.
Wow.
And for me, as an artistic director, as a music director, this is extraordinary, because it means we're doing things financially sustainably and we're positioned to take risks. People forget that risk taking is not important just in business. If you want to make if you want to make great gains, do something special in business, it's understood you have to have risk capital. Well, we may call it creative capital in the arts, but you have to be positioned in a way so that you can do something that could potentially fail. Because you're never going to really succeed with something great unless there's a potential for failure. That's why every performance, you almost want to be on the edge at some point, so that there's that extra intensity and sense of risk, or at least spontaneity, let's call it. So to be a part of this story in Arkansas has really been a great, great moment for my life. And to share this wonderful rapport and relationship with an orchestra of musicians right now that is excited and thriving and happy, I'm so happy as a conductor to have this. It's a rare thing to walk on stage and be surrounded by that kind of atmosphere in every rehearsal and performance.
Well, we wish you great success there, and we look forward to the results this Saturday night with the Tulsa Symphony. Philip, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been an absolute pleasure. You have a fantastic orchestra in the Tulsa Symphony. I think everyone in this community should be very, very proud. Thanks for having me.
Guest conductor Philip Mann, the music director of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra, will lead the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this weekend as he leads the TSO in Sergei Rachmaninoff Symphony No. 2, Samuel Barber's Essay No. 1 for orchestra, and the Mozart Horn Concerto No. 2 with orchestra principal Bruce Schultz as soloist. The concert takes place this Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Chapman Music Hall of the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Ticket information at tulsasymphony.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.